A podcast of the cinema.
Hey, Alonzo Duralde.
Yes, Dave White.
tell everyone about me and how much you like me.
Don't push it. You are a film critic for The Wrap and co-host of this program, and an author and essayist and occasional NPR contributor person.
Okay.
I don't know.
You're just giving them my resume.
Well, you said about, we're introducing ourselves at the top of the
show.
I
said tell them what you like about me.
I'm
real cute.
You're supposed to let me answer this question. You bake.
I bake nice things.
You make me laugh.
That's just
every day.
A fact. Not every day.
No. At some point. You annoy the crap out of me most days, but you do make me laugh every day.
And you're my sidekick. So welcome everyone to the show.
Oh, that's hilarious.
No, you know what's weird? I woke up this morning thinking about how you are, like, ascending.
Oh, shush.
No, think about this. I was thinking about someone used this word about you not recently, not long ago, quite recently. And I don't remember now who it was that said this.
I'm going to bang my head on the ceiling.
They were talking about your career ascendance, and I don't remember the person. And when I heard that word, I thought, that's accurate, because think about it. You're the dude with the rap.
Mm-hmm.
You're the editor, reviews editor.
Mm-hmm.
We are now routinely encountering people on the street in the city, just walking around, who come up to you and say, oh, hey, I really love you on What the Flick, like in a Starbucks parking lot or on a sidewalk somewhere, you know.
That's a little weird, but yeah, people are looking
at this. Happens like every couple weeks, and I'm there when it happens, and I'm thinking to myself, this didn't used to happen all the time.
Yeah.
So What the Flick is growing, apparently,
I guess,
in numbers, and people are noticing you.
Or Matt Atchity lost weight, and so I'm now more recognizable as the only fat beardo
right.
on the
they
show.
They don't confuse you both anymore.
Right.
He's such a trim little flower now.
He's a whippet.
Yeah. And then you know what? And shaving off the beard makes you look even skinnier. You know?
Hello, world. I have no chins to hide.
But so, okay, so like those things. And then, you know, there was that moment where the well-known person walked up to you and said, oh, hey, I just have to tell you how much I loved you on What the Flick. And that was like,
that was nutty.
That was weird. And then now you hosted all those, you did all those hosting segments on Filmstruck for TCM.
Which you now have to kind of dig to find.
That's fine.
Gay and lesbian cinema sort of moved down the stack.
June was your moment of being a star.
And now it's August.
Now they just need to bring you back for whatever else that they have for you to do. Maybe they will.
Maybe.
Who knows? But then, now you're a 3-month
fill-in
artist in residence.
Yes, I'm doing.
with Pop Rocket because Margaret Wappler, the co-host, is out on maternity leave. Yes. So they just rang you up and said, hey, do you want to be one of our four panelists every week for the next 3 months? So now you're doing that.
Literally everyone else said no. Would you come in and
we do don't
this?
Know what number on the call sheet you were. You might have been the 9th or the 19th person they called, and all the other people, the first 8 or the first 18, said, ooh, no, you don't know. But either way, you're the dude now. And so then there's that, and now there's this other thing coming that we still can't talk about yet. That we're just teasing.
It will soon be a thing.
But you're going to maybe be, I mean...
Yes.
All signs point to a thing is happening.
Yes.
That's a nice little thing.
Yes.
It's just another nice little thing. And when it becomes an actual reality that you can consume, we'll tell you what that is.
We will.
You're going to the Venice Film Festival at the end of the month to cover that.
Yes.
I'm
whatever.
You're being a big deal. A big deal. I'm very proud of you.
Well, thanks.
I tell everybody, look at my husband, Alonzo Duralde, what he does. I'm the Mac in the back.
Things are nice. I'm very grateful for what's happening, and I do not in any way kid myself.
I'm like smooth and ready for the camera. You got smart words on your mouth all the time. If I were the man, it wouldn't be me, and it's not me because I'm a doofus in the head.
Oh, please.
So there you go.
You're the real critic of the household.
Yeah. So yeah, this is I'm just feeling very cool about you. And great things. I mean,
things are hopping.
Great
it's,
things.
It is nice.
Okay, not great. I mean, not great. Like, as not big, but nice.
Yes,
nice things.
What's happening?
So many movies.
I know.
Also, things
just to slow down in August? Like, doesn't the no? Apparently not.
Things are going to slow down. Probably like after the second week, this coming week.
Right.
Like this episode, we have a gang of movies to talk about.
Yeah.
Some that we held over from last week.
Right.
And, I've looked at the box office Mojo schedule for the end of August, and
it dwindles.
It'll slow down a little bit. Not today. Satan.
Well, the first weekend of August apparently is like, you know, that's when the first Guardians of the Galaxy opened. That's when Suicide Squad opened. So it can be a launch pad for like one sort of last hurrah of the summer. Or you have a year like this one where it's like the beginning of the end and nothing really, you know, explodes into the firmament. Like The Dark Tower, for instance, which is...
Yeah.
Somehow managed to be number one this weekend, but like with less than $20 million. So it's like, whatever.
So think about that, right? Less than $20 million for the number one movie in August. The audience is already telling the film industry what they're going to be doing in August.
Right.
All right. And that's what happens every August unless something huge opens.
Yeah.
But nothing huge is opening this month.
No.
They haven't saved anything, you know...
They haven't saved
anything for August.
Yeah.
Which is, sometimes you can kind of count on that. You can kind of count on at least one thing.
For a while,
the studio said, hey, we're going to put this in August because the playing field is otherwise pretty clear.
Like, I think for a couple of years, that was like the Judd Apatow moment.
Yes.
Where, like, at the end of the summer, you'd get like Superbad.
Some raunchy comedy.
40-Year-Old Virgin or something.
Right. But they didn't want to hold off on Girls Trip, and now we have Girls Trip.
Yes.
Y'all go see Girls Trip.
You should. You'll be glad
just
you did.
Talking about that yesterday all over again with other friends, and it made me want to go see it again. So yeah, the audience is like, yeah, we're all going to other
Oh, there's a
places. Yeah, there's a
barbecue.
barbecue. So that's what's happening.
Yes.
It also doesn't help that the Dark Tower is very bad.
Yes, as it turns
It is
out.
a very bad film.
Neither of us read these books. These books have a big following.
I have a feeling, based on conversations that I have had with friends who are committed to the Dark Tower books. There's more than one, right?
It's like 8 or 9, I
Okay.
think. And this movie was supposed to
A
launch
whole everything.
like more movies and
TV
a TV series
show,
and
and
the show might still be happening,
I'll
but
tell you something. The show should probably still happen because I think this is a project that can stretch out
yes.
and be as detailed as it needs to be
With the real estate.
on television.
Yeah.
Because I watched this film and it was as though they were speaking in code because I did not understand what was going on at all. Just when I thought I knew what was happening, more stuff would happen that I bet has an entire chapter devoted to it
Right.
in the book, and you get to see it for 10 seconds, and then they go, and then blah blah blah.
Wait,
Oh, what's blah blah blah? Is that a thing?
what?
Should I be paying attention to that? Is it very important?
Will this be on the final?
Is it going to come back? Oh, am I going to see it again in the movie? No, I'm not. You're not. No one is. Blah, blah, blah. It just happened.
We're never mentioning it again.
And we're not talking about it anymore. There's a gunslinger played by Idris Elba. And there is a kid played by a young boy named Tom Taylor, I think is his name.
That sounds right.
And they did some reshoots because there are moments in this film where the kid is visibly older
Yes. Like,
and
I thought he was going to have a mustache at one
then
point.
goes back to being a younger looking boy.
Yeah.
It was shot just at that cusp of adolescence where you're just like grow like overnight. You wake up and you've got a little mustache,
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
like
Somebody
it's
called him and said, "Hey, we're doing some additional photography." Really?
right.
Oh no.
Yeah, oh no. And you know, the costumers have to come back in and fix it because he's got taller
We've
now.
got to fix his
His
bangs.
face looks more grown in some scenes. It's very weird. It's sad. It's sad for the movie.
And it would be forgivable for the movie if that were the only thing wrong with it.
Yeah. So he's the kid. He's the special kid. He's going to help the gunslinger save. This is everything I can understand.
Okay.
Save the Dark Tower from the Man in Black. The Man in Black is played by Matthew McConaughey in a performance that I actually did really truly enjoy because he is so much like greasy, waxy white devil with bizarre, like, I don't know what the sebum stick they rolled all over his face and what the weird hair
They give him a
piece.
weird, like, slick powler.
Yeah, he's got this weird hair piece on his head, and it's clearly not real.
I was reminded of John Travolta in Battlefield Earth, doing this, it's sort of like larger than life villain, sort of Disney villainess performance.
Yeah. He is.
Not that it's enough to make you want to go see the movie, but it's something.
He's functioning as a camp object
Yeah.
in this otherwise very earnest film.
Yes.
That's fun to watch. He's such a devil person that he can look right at you and say, "Stop breathing," and then you just die.
Yeah,
And I really dug that.
he's like
I would enjoy having that power.
he's like the purple man on Jessica
Yeah.
Jones.
So they're trying to save the gunslinger and the kid are trying to save the Dark Tower from the Man in Black because the Man in Black wants to destroy the Dark Tower so that the worlds, there's more than
All
one,
the parallel universes.
the worlds will descend into chaos and the monsters will come and get everybody. Now the monsters show up sporadically here, and they are shot in such a way that you can barely make them out. The scenes themselves that contain the monsters and the fighting and the running from the monsters are so dark and poorly lit that it is hard to make out details in the frame.
There are a lot of nighttime action sequences in this movie that are not
coherent,
filmed in a way that you can see what's going on.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and you're looking at it
thinking, you want to grab a flashlight.
I need to know what's happening. I can't actually see what's happening.
Yeah, so this is apparently on the page, this rich and involved narrative that sort of drags in sort of every genre and, you know, all these fictional characters and fictional worlds and very self-referential to Stephen King's own writing. And, you know, yeah, we do get the lead kid. You know, we're always told that he's got the shine. And there's a few other little, you know, Easter eggs along the way. But this movie plays like a crappy YA franchise starter, you know, about this special boy and then the warrior that he teams up with, who's also like the last of his kind, and, you know, his guns are forged from Excalibur and somebody made the joke that this movie is like The Last Action Hero without the wit, because it is about this kid sort of crossing over into like these kind of fictional landscapes. But it's like, yeah, it's like if the kid in The Last Action Hero crossed over into Divergent, you know, because it feels like it's the same old stakes. It's the fate of the world, and it's the only the one boy with the special blah 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 can stop the blah blah blah, you know.
Well, listen, you can't stop the blah 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 if the blah 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 is only on screen for 10 seconds. How are you going to catch it?
That's true.
You can't catch it. You can't hold it. It's gone. Give us more of the blah 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 so we know what we're supposed to paying attention to.
I don't even know what the tower, like how the tower works.
No, they never tell you.
All we're told is it's the only thing standing between us and the monsters. And we know that Matthew McConaughey is like snatching children from all the dimensions and trying to like...
It's like in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Exactly. Trying to use their shine power to like blast it with their brains.
They do all have, the kids all have the shining, which is a nice, you know, reference to other... Stephen King jam. There is a big St. Bernard that gets walked down a street at the beginning of the movie, so you got that little, what's up, Cujo? You know,
there's a Rita Hayworth poster hanging in the back of a
Shawshank,
thing.
But
none of that means anything.
No, it doesn't mean anything. It's just like little eggs. Yeah. This is a terrible film. Don't go see this. If you've never read these books, you will just be confused. And if you have read the books, and I've talked to two people who are devoted to the books, and they're so angry, they're not even going to go see the movie. Mm. But if you do go see the movie, as a fan of the books, I have already heard from Facebook that you will be full of rage.
Yes. This definitely falls in the category of like, well, I don't know that I was ever going to read the book before, but I'm definitely not reading it now.
Right.
Like when we saw, was it Revolution Road?
Yes.
Everybody said that novel was great, and it may well be.
That's what I hear.
But that movie was so...
I will never find out.
Crappy. I was like, nope, never reading it. Sorry.
Why don't you talk about Fun Mom Dinner? Oh. Because I don't think I have encountered a film with a stupider title in all of 2017.
It's pretty
and
dumb.
I saw 2/3 of the Emoji Movie.
Fun Mom Dinner.
What language was that originally in? That title.
Big American Party.
Yeah.
So it's...
I did not see this movie, by the way. You watched it on a screener.
Yeah.
And you threw it to the television from your phone, and it kept stopping up on you, so you had to switch back to your laptop to watch it there.
Right.
And I saw the first 10 minutes, and it's full of people I like, and not one funny thing happened in this comedy in the first 10 minutes.
Only about 3 funny things happen over the course of the entire movie.
Knock it out real fast.
This is one of those things where you think, oh, but this cast, it's so great. How bad could it be?
Right.
Oh, never ask that question. Katie Azleton is the new mom at this school, and she's friends with, she becomes friends with Molly Shannon and Bridget Everett, whose kids also go there, and they invite her to this periodic fun mom dinner. And Katie Azleton's like, sure, great. Oh, can I bring my other friend, Toni Collette? And they're all,
she doesn't sound like fun.
Because they don't like Toni Collette. Toni Collette doesn't like them. And, but, you know, she sort of tricks Toni Collette into coming to this dinner. And at first it's all awkward and they're saying nasty things to each other. But then Toni Collette and Bridget Everett get stoned. And then suddenly everything's great.
You know what? Weed makes people happy and friends.
Yes.
Always.
And then all of them get stoned. And then they all have this, like, crazy night out while the husbands are at home taking care of the kids.
A fun mom dinner.
Yes. So Katie Azleton is married to Adam Scott, who's being kind of a jerk. And Toni Collette is married to Rob Hubel. And so they're minding the kids and they're having their own sort of like bonding moments and talking about how parenting works and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, the ladies are out cutting loose and singing karaoke and Katie Azleton's flirting with a bar owner played by Adam Levine. And yeah, it is airless, this movie. There's a few funny things. There's a funny film reference at the end that's kind of like, it's the sort of thing you'll see in clip shows one day and not remember what this movie is about.
Right.
Or Adam Scott sort of recreates a famous 80s movie moment. But yeah, it's less than whatever. And it's sad because, yeah, you know, all of those people I just named, I think they're funny. You know, Paul Rudd is in this thing and Paul Rust and David Wayne and I forget who else.
But is it even opening wide? It's not, right?
It's streaming. It's day and date. So it's in a few theaters and it's on demand. So you could conceivably watch this in the U.S. wherever you are.
Who has a demand for it?
That's
anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. It's meh. Especially, you know, it made me reappreciate Girls Trip. It made me reappreciate Bad Moms.
Yeah.
So yeah, me.
We've got a couple more that only you have seen.
Right.
One of which I still want to catch up on, which is Atomic Blonde.
Right.
I hear it's not very good, but I do hear that it has the kind of stuff that I do want to look at.
Sure, yes.
That John Wick-style choreographed fighting that is more like dancing than
yes.
anything else.
There are like three
yeah.
action sequences in this movie that are so great, and the guy who directed the film was sort of the uncredited co-director of John Wick, you know, longtime stunt coordinator, stunt man. So knows his action stuff really well. And so when you get Charlize Theron like in a car and using her high heel shoe to like stab people in the neck, or taking out a squadron of East German policemen with a garden hose, or in this lengthy sequence that is cut to look like it's one continuous take, but of course it isn't, where she and these goons are beating the crap out of each other, and it's the kind of fight where by the end of it, like, they're all exhausted and they're still like trying to hit each other effectively, but they're all like kind of wobbling because they're just, you know, the kind of thing you often see in a movie fight. You know, those sequences are great and unimpeachable and made me think I would love to see this as a series of films, so that by like number three we'll be like, okay, now they've really nailed it. Now they know what this is about. And
oh, wait,
you know,
we'd have to sit through a second one where they hadn't quite nailed it yet?
I'm just guessing.
I'm done with series of films.
I'm just saying,
seriously,
like,
F all of them.
I'm just saying,
irritating.
I wouldn't mind seeing more movies of, like, you know, a 80s glammed up Charlize Theron beating the crap out of people.
Get it right the first time, then you might be allowed to have a sequel.
Well, they do not get it right the first time, because when she is not fighting,
the end.
When she is not fighting and the movie is actually talking, it's sort of...
And if you get it right the first time and then don't quite get it right the second time, you're done. You're not a franchise anymore. You're just a good movie that had a sequel. John Wick.
I liked the sequel to John Wick. I thought it was fine. Outside of those three fight sequences, you know, this is, it's set in Berlin and it's 1989 and the wall is about to come down, and there are stories to be told about that specific moment in the Cold War and what that, and how that would affect people like the characters in the movie who are
right.
all like steeped in international espionage, but the movie's not really all that interested in it. And it's one of those movies where everything that happens is being told in flashback, Like, the movie starts with Charlize Theron being debriefed by her MI6 boss, Toby Jones, and the CIA guy played by John Goodman. So it's like, well, we know that she lived long enough to come into the office and tell this story. So there's that aspect of it. And then there's like all these sort of turnarounds and switcheroos in Act 3 where like, wait, who, huh? And then that person is this now? And how does that... It's like, if I were to see this movie again, knowing how this movie ends, I don't think it would make any difference. I don't think it would color, oh, so it turned out that this meant that. No, right. I don't think it makes any sense. I think it's just sort of this cheap kind of like, ha-ha, fooled ya. And so that's disappointing. But, you know, Theron's great. She's always fun to watch.
She's watchable, yeah.
And, you know, she gets some hot lezzy moments with a...
Oh, that's right. She does make out with a woman in the trailer. Yes,
with the mummy.
The trailer is why... And I'm the guy who doesn't see trailers, but I somehow wound up seeing it twice in front of other movies. And I didn't close my eyes because the first time I saw the trailer, they started playing New Order's Blue Monday, and I opened my eyes because I thought, wait, what's that? What? Charlize Theron is kicking people in the face to Blue Monday. Blue Monday has been my mental hold music for 34 years. Not a day goes by where the rhythm in my head is not. And so I perked right up at that trailer and I was like, ooh, Charlize Theron kicking people in the face to Blue Monday. I'll go see this.
There's a lot of music supervision in this movie, and it runs a gamut. Like, there are times where the choices are kind of clever, like, you know, because it's Berlin, you get the German language version of 99 Luftballon and the German language version of Major Tom.
Yeah.
You know, was it Peter Schiller? Peter Schilling?
You're asking me a question that is not related to New Order.
Fine. Anyway, but then there are literally two different scenes where people are whispering secrets to each other, and they play Voices Carry really loud.
Well, that's stupid.
That's stupid.
But Amy Mann gets a check.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good for Amy Mann.
Yes, always in favor of that. And then I was really kind of... I was taken out of it by the moment where Sofia Boutella, the mummy, takes her to this like hip... You know, kind of underground Berlin disco.
Right.
And they're all dancing to...
The politics
reflexes
of dancing.
The politics of dancing. I'm like, no.
You came home complaining about that.
I bought that 12-inch single in, what, 83 when that song was a hit?
If it was a very cool...
It was not cool in 1989.
If it was a very cool place to dance in Europe in 1989... they were dancing to house music.
Exactly.
Not to the politics of dancing.
I mean,
that's just the thing.
Like, there's an underground club that James McAvoy runs in East Berlin, and they play Fight the Power. It's like, okay, yes.
That's exactly 1989.
Exactly. Somebody who is all about, like, smuggling in great stuff from the West would totally be on target like that.
Yes.
McAvoy, by the way, who plays this agent who's, you know, affiliations are questionable. We now know if James McAvoy is in a movie and has his hair buzzed off,
you know exactly the performance he
is about to give.
Yeah.
It's going to be that twitchy, maniacal thing. You know, McAvoy with hair is a chill bro. So yeah, I like what this movie gets right, but there's not enough of it.
Yeah. And then you saw Wind River, which I had an interest in for about 5 minutes until you started telling me about it.
Well, you know, it's funny. We'll be talking later about sort of the ongoing discussion and your ongoing thoughts about Detroit. And I'm kind of surprised that no one is talking about the race politics of this movie, because it is about a murder of a Native American woman on a Native American reservation where the lead characters are white people. And the writer and director is a white person. And there are some supporting Native American characters, and they're, you know, good performances. It's, you know, Gil Birmingham and Graham Greene, and they're always terrific. But ultimately, it's about, you know, Jeremy Renner and Jeremy Renner's pain, you know. And that it's that thing where, because Jeremy Renner's ex-wife was Native American and he had kids who were, you know, I guess mixed, whatever, you know, he gets a pass. Like, the whole movie, except for with one exception, every Native American character, like, sort of welcomes him as one of their own, which is that white fantasy of, you know, like, going into the enclave and being, you know, treated like one of them. So Renner plays a hunter for the Fish and Wildlife Service. He goes to the reservation that his ex-wife's family is from because they've had some problems with a mountain lion. And as he's tracking it down, comes across a body of a young woman who was like, was a teenager, and she was barefoot and in the snow, and like, how did she get there? And we come to find out that Renner's own daughter died, you know, years earlier, who's about the same age and actually was friends with this girl, so it dredges up a lot of his emotional past. Elizabeth Olsen shows up as an FBI agent who's been assigned to the case, and this movie kind of made me like Sicario less in retrospect.
Right.
It's also written by Taylor Sheridan, who's directing for the first time in addition. And it's like, she's so frequently incompetent, or at least out of her depth,
yeah,
and having to be told by the dudes, like, oh, hey, don't stand there, you'll get shot, or you should put on a heavier coat, or, you know, like, all this stuff, and it just, I don't know, it kind of got on my nerves. Also, they bracket the movie with, you know, like, based on a true story at the beginning, and then at the very end, it says, there's this title card that says, that Native American women are the only group in the United States that they don't collect missing persons statistics for. And so we don't even know how many of them go missing every year. And it's kind of like, well, that's terrible, but what does that have to do with the movie we just saw? Because somebody finds a dead Native American woman and, like, the FBI is there instantly. It's not like he finds her and goes, oh, well, no one's keeping statistics on this, not going to investigate this murder. Like, it's not relevant to the film. It just feels like this sort of tacked on thing of like, well, yeah, that's a bad thing. How does that relate to this movie? And the whole time I was watching it, I just kept thinking, I bet there were several drafts of this script where Jeremy Renner's character was Native American.
Yeah.
It would have made perfect sense. But somewhere along the way, I was like,
that's what I'm thinking.
Somewhere along the way, I was like, we need a star here. We really need a name.
And oops, we don't have any Native American stars who can headline a movie and get butts into seats and tickets into the hands.
So, yeah, so that just, I don't know, that rubbed me the wrong way. But people, this movie's getting really good reviews.
Is it?
So, you know.
Okay.
I'm sure, I'm not reading the comments on What the Flick, but I'm sure the SJW is being thrown at me for bringing this up. You know?
You just say, all you have to do is say, hey, this character doesn't seem like he should be white. And people will have a conniption at you. Too bad, white people. You don't get to have everything.
Mm.
We all got to learn that lesson.
Yes.
I'm white. He's white. Guess what? Other people who aren't white are in the world.
That's right.
You leave the world.
Too bad. The movie you saw that I did not see.
Yes.
Was Franche.
It was. Oui. False Confessions.
Okay.
Is the name of the film. Backstory. This is from Luc Bondy, a theater director in France, much more known for his theater work than his film work. He's made a few films in the course of his life.
Okay.
Very old. He died in 2015 before this film was completely finished.
Oh.
And his wife finished it.
Like in post? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then it played in France and Europe in 2016, and now finally in 2017, it's coming to the United States in a very, very, very limited release. Like, it just left Los Angeles.
Right.
I don't know what other cities it will go to. It's
If it gets around, it's going to be
because it has star power.
It has Isabelle Huppert.
It stars Isabelle Huppert and Louis Garrel, who is he the heartthrob of French cinema right now? Is he their go-to?
I guess him or Jeremy Renier.
Maybe. He is the most good-looking, depressed-looking person.
Which is essential if you want to be a French movie star.
Yeah, it's... He has this, like, sexy glum mug. Anyway, this is a fascinating film that does not entirely work. Because Bondi was a theater guy, this film is based on a production of the play False Confessions that he did in 2014.
Right.
At the Odeon in Paris. The stage production starred Isabelle Huppert and Louis Garrel. So, the film is set in the theater. Inside the theater. It's not that you're watching a filmed stage play. You're watching the actors perform the play in other parts of the theater.
Oh.
That is standing in for a giant aristocratic mansion. So when they're on the grand steps...
Meet me at the snack bar.
They're on the grand steps leading down into the entry of the home, you see the exit sign.
Okay.
When they are in the rehearsal space of the theater... The only space, really, that looks like a room.
Yeah.
There are curtains. There are, like, drapes across, like, one wall covering what? An external, another different space.
A fire door.
There are, like...
Do they use the stage at all?
Hang on.
Okay.
They are frequently walking around backstage. So you see all the
ropes,
gear and ropes and pulleys and stuff backstage. They are in other spaces in the theater, and there will just be screens separating things, and you're meant to understand that they are in someone's sitting room or someone's bedroom or some other room in this giant aristocratic mansion. But you're not. You're in the theater where the play is happening, and Luc Bondy is shooting the film in the hours before nightly performances. So the actor's like, yeah, we'll come in early.
Nightly performances of this show.
Uh-huh.
I see.
While the show was running, he was shooting the movie concurrently.
Well, you're already here.
Yes. And they said, sure, yeah, we'll do that. That'll be fine.
So he's basically making a love letter to the theater. Kinda. And also to this theater.
And also to this theater. And... The final shot of the movie, well, no, the second to final shot of the movie is on the actual stage, which is kind of a minimalist design. It's much more, visually representative when you go backstage to the places where they're actually shooting the film.
So people who saw the play saw basically this sort of like Our Town version.
It seems to have been like that. Now, I don't know because we only see the final the final scene of the play.
But in the movie,
in a stage design that looks fairly minimal.
In the movie, you get the lushness of all of the like outer trappings of the Odeon.
Of the actual theater.
Okay, interesting.
And then the final shot.
Interesting concept.
The final shot of the movie is the actors leaving the theater after work.
Huh.
Like smoking cigarettes and saying, okay, bye, good night, see you tomorrow.
Like, so this is kind of like Vanya on 42nd Street.
Yes, ish. Now, it doesn't entirely work.
Okay.
Because he's got weird ideas about where to put the camera.
Huh.
And I think this meant to highlight the artificiality of things. You know, like he'll just hover above them sometimes. He'll be way up top of the stairs, and they'll be way down at the bottom of the stairs. And Isabelle Huppert's shoes will be lining the stairs. For what reason? We don't know. There are, you know, some really terrific shoes and really terrific outfits on Isabelle Huppert. If all you want to do is just look at this, you know, impeccable creature that is Isabelle Huppert wear a lot of really cool outfits... It's a cool 85-minute film.
I just heard Louis Vertel running out to find a theater where this is showing.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunately not showing in Los Angeles anymore. it highlights, you know, the artifice.
Right.
Now, the story is where things get really weird, because this is based on a play by Pierre de Marivaux, written in 1737. It's pre-revolutionary France.
Right.
And it's about aristocrats and their servants and their love schemes.
Mm-hmm. Machinations.
Now, I took my friend Robert, who is a theater stage designer.
Right.
Because I thought that that aspect of it would interest him. And on the way to there, he said, I'm curious, actually, about the play itself, because here's what Marivaux does. Or Marivaux. I'm sure... I'm sorry, again, with French names, I just can't say anything properly until someone teaches me. He said, the thing we probably will run into in this film is the humiliation of servants as a comedy act. Because this is a rom-com in the weirdest sense.
Like Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah. And, yeah, kind of. That is what happens. The idea that, well, they're servants, so you can do anything you want to them. And if they're ruined by the end of the play in the service of the love of the aristocracy, that's fine. We'll just make their humiliation comic, and it'll be okay. Listen, Bastille Day is celebrated for a reason.
Because of this BS.
Because of this sort of thing. But it's an interesting movie anyway.
Okay.
Because it's just so unusual. It will be, in the career of Huppert and Garel, one of those weird little footnotes,
right,
you know, that will probably eventually become difficult to find. So if you want to see it...
Catch it now.
Hunt it down now, because 20 years from now, it'll probably be not available anywhere. Right.
You got me thinking about the sort of mixed history of theater directors going to film.
Uh-huh.
And it's a mixed bag. I mean, there have been some good ones, but you also get like Morton DaCosta, guy who's best known for two hugely successful films, and then pretty much, I think, made one other one and then never directed another movie. He directed The Music Man and Anti-Mame on Broadway.
Yes.
And then directed the movie versions.
Right.
And Music Man is pretty opened up, and, you know, I think it helps that it's set in a town, and so you can build a town on the back lot, and then that kind of, like, liberates you a bit. But Anti-Mame, for all that's good about it, is very theatrical.
It's very stage-bound in that way.
I mean, it even, like, each sort of scene or act kind of ends with, like, you know, this sort of iris spotlight on Rosalind Russell.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, they change the decor of the apartment, and she's got some new outfits on, and bam, off we go. You know, it is very stagey that way. I'd say the worst example that comes to mind is Harold Prince, who had this amazing run with Stephen Sondheim of directing a lot of his musicals.
Right.
Directed the film version of Sondheim's A Little Night Music, the one with Elizabeth Taylor singing Send in the Clowns.
Right.
And boy, does he not ever want to move that camera.
Right.
It is so stiff and stagey and locked down, and it's not good. And it's a great show, but the movie is... Even when it's not Elizabeth Taylor, like when Len Carew or people who know what they're doing as you know, stage musical comedy goes... It's well nigh unwatchable.
And then we saw Kidnap. Which is not a, you know,
a great
movie, or even probably
necessarily a good one. But it's effective.
But sure is fun.
Yeah.
Halle Berry is a waitress, mm-hmm. just like she was in Monsters Ball.
Right.
And she has a little kid. And she takes the kid to the park one day, and the kid gets kidnapped. And she sees the kid being whisked into this crappy car. So she jumps in her minivan, and on the way to jumping in the minivan, she loses her phone.
Yeah.
Because she's frantic.
Or there'd be no movie.
And she chases them. And she chases them, and she chases them, and she chases them. And a lot of wild things happen as she's chasing them. both on her part and on the part of the kidnappers.
Yes.
And so many innocent people would appear to be slaughtered in the way, in the service of
her pursuit.
Her pursuit.
Or at least gravely injured.
Yeah. And that's like the first half of the movie, and then the next half of the movie is not in the cars.
Like the last third.
Yeah, not in the cars, and she is gonna Liam Neeson then.
Yeah.
And she does.
She is Ms. Taken.
Did you? Thank you. Ms. Taken. Thank you, Alonzo Duralde.
You're welcome.
Yes. I had just hit the microphone.
Yay.
The great thing about this movie is Halle Berry taking control of the... She is seizing the means of production. She is the executive producer of this film.
Yeah.
Because she said, you know what? The Call. I was in The Call a couple years ago, and that movie is about a kid that gets kidnapped, and I save them. And now I'm going to do another one where I save my own kid from being kidnapped.
And I don't even call 911.
And I don't even have a phone. I don't need no 911. We're going to make that movie, because The Call made some money. It did pretty well, right? If you're wondering why we don't call it the name that we used to call it, it's because that name is probably
problematic.
It's probably racist and problematic, and we weren't thinking about that at the time, but now we're thinking about it.
Yes.
And we're not going to do that anymore.
No. We can learn things.
Yes.
If we knew better, we'd do better.
And we did.
But we like kidnap a lot.
But we did kidnap, and I like how she has decided, oh, you're not going to give me any good parts in movies anymore. I do have an Academy Award for acting.
Oh, but I'm still a black woman working in contemporary Hollywood, and these are the scripts you're offering me?
And so she's just doing it herself.
Yeah.
She's going to hit, she's in her 40s now, right?
I would think.
She knows what's up.
Mm-hmm.
She's taken control. And I applaud this. I would like it if she would do the thing I wish all, you know, prestige A-list actors would do and go
find cool young filmmakers and hot-foot it
to
indies with them.
To, you know, really, you know, really, really strong, pushy kind of filmmakers who are doing interesting, new, daring, strong work and give themselves to that person and say, look, what can I do for you?
But here's the thing. I mean, let's think about this. Because, like, for example, you know, one of the things that people are praising, and rightfully so, Queen Sugar for doing, the Ava DuVernay, Oprah Winfrey show.
Yeah.
They are high. It's all women directors.
Yes.
A lot of them women of color. A lot of them queer women of color. So, like, you know, Cheryl Dunye, Tina Mabry, Aurora Guerrero.
Right.
You know, and that's great, and I'm glad they're working. If one of those filmmakers has Halle Berry show up on their doorstep, can they get a budget from that? Or is it going to be the same old, nope, sorry, you know?
I don't know.
Because I'm with you. I want people
who have... what I'm saying really is go to Europe. Because in Europe, the state finances the film production.
No, I'm with you. I want people with clout to be like, all right, I'm going to make this stupid, like, X-Men movie and make however many mil and cover my house payment for a couple years, and now I'm gonna
spend $1 million of my own money and bankroll and be the producer of this other film by this really interesting filmmaker, and I'm gonna star.
Okay, so they gotta pay for it too.
Why not?
All right.
I know that's the rule. I know the rule is you're not supposed to.
Yeah.
But who cares? Break those rules. Please. Anyway, you know, but in the absence of that, if she's not going to, you know, go begging at the door of my go-to, Claire Denis, then
Andre Téchiné.
Then she has every right and more power to her for putting out a movie like Kidnap, because it's a B movie.
Yeah.
It is a genre film,
mm-hmm.
and it is a lot of fun. It's exciting. It never stops.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps moving. It's the kind that made actual film critics at the actual press screening yell at the screen.
Yes. Which does not happen.
The bad people are so very bad that when she does finally get them, you're just like, yes! Cheering and clapping. And those bad people, I said this already on KCRW, but those bad people are such trash. They make the Winter's Bone cast look like Downton Abbey.
It has been pointed out that it's a big deal that the three wide releases this weekend,
yes,
all feature black talent, Dark Tower, Detroit, and Kidnap.
Hmm.
Which is notable because it has to be notable.
Right. Yes. So, let us now revisit Detroit.
Okay. And by us, you mean you.
By us, I mean me. I had a lot of scattered thoughts last week, none of which felt to me after the fact while listening to it. None of them felt coherent. I just got on the microphone last week and I just went, blah, here's all the things I think about Detroit and how, no matter how disconnected those thoughts may be, y'all can just sort them out yourselves. But I don't like to be that kind of film critic who doesn't have his thoughts all nailed down. And I still don't have my thoughts entirely nailed down, because as the year goes on and we think more about this film and what it means and who made it and what its purpose is, I think we're gonna hear from more people about this film. We're going to understand it maybe differently at the end of the year. Maybe 5 years from now, we'll understand it differently. So here's what I think. Catherine Bigelow. Because this movie opens wide this week, so now you have a chance to see it if you don't live in New York or Los Angeles or Detroit.
Or Chicago.
Catherine Bigelow makes a very specific kind of film. And she has made another one here. In keeping with Hurt Locker, in keeping with Zero Dark Thirty. She has made a film that is both a history lesson and a commentary on the world as it exists right now. I'm torn, still, a week later. I don't have a definitive opinion yet. I'm still torn, but at least I think I now have my ideas in a row of what's got me bugged. I'm torn between thinking that this very well-constructed film, this really effective, physical, muscular movie, I'm torn between thinking that what this film is doing as a history lesson and a commentary is important and vital, while at the same time worrying that Catherine Bigelow, as a white filmmaker, working in the context of a white-dominated film industry, which exists in the context of a country predicated on white supremacy, what might, no matter how well-intentioned and full of consultants and a black cast that's ready to go and do the work, what is she missing by virtue of being white? Furthermore, what am I missing as a white viewer by virtue of being white? I don't know.
Can we?
But is it something? Would this film be different? Like I said last week, I was kind of joking, but would this film have been different if Ava DuVernay had made it? Or Dee Reese? Or Spike Lee?
Well,
yes.
Yes.
And what would they have done? I don't know. But it would have been something different. And
it would also have been different if Robert Townsend had directed.
That is correct. We won't know until one of those filmmakers makes a film about this same subject, which can happen. God knows we had two Truman Capote movies.
Godard always said the best way to review a movie is to make another movie.
Make another movie. The film I saw when I watched it with you was punishing, and I felt, you know, very effective.
Effected.
Effective.
Oh, okay.
Effective.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
I think you said I felt very effective. You're saying I felt comma very effective. Okay.
I felt the film was effective.
Yes. Okay.
I already knew what I needed to know. So this film didn't teach me anything about white supremacy. I already knew it. Now that's, you know, hooray for me. Okay. I worry that the people who actually need to understand this film, to understand the point of this film, who people who need it the most, and by that I mean terrible white people, they're not going to voluntarily see this film. And the black audiences, even more than me, don't need to see this movie to learn anything about white supremacy. So that is my feeling right now.
Okay. Will you acknowledge that there is a chunk of the white audience that maybe intellectually understands the nature of what this film is about and the events that it's portraying, but that seeing it and experiencing it in the visceral way that this film offers might, if not change their mind, sort of strengthen their understanding of a thing that they only think they really know?
Sure.
Because I don't think it's as diametrically that the choices are either you're super racist and you're never going to see this movie, or you are already on board with this and thus you don't need to see this movie.
Sure.
Okay.
We're not done talking about this.
I know we're not.
This is going to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for, obviously, listeners, if you've seen the movie and you have thoughts, let us know, but only if you've seen the movie. Let's be fair about that.
Do I have a DVD this week? I don't know that
you were the one who brought it up earlier. I thought you were totally on it.
I wasn't. I do have a Blu-ray.
Ooh.
Warner Archive.
Yes.
Has just put out Running on Empty.
Oh, good one.
1989, 1990, what year was that?
88.
88.
I reviewed it for the Nashville Banner.
Judd Hirsch.
Mm-hmm.
Christine Lottie.
Mm-hmm.
Young River Phoenix.
Yep.
Martha Plimpton.
Mm-hmm. The Stephen Hill as Christine Lottie's father has a great scene.
Directed by Sidney Lumet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a family. The parents were anti-war activists in the 60s. They blew up a napalm lab, and now they are fugitives 20 years later.
They didn't know the janitor was going to be in there after hours, and so they are murderers on the run.
Yeah.
They have a family who have constantly to change their identities and schools.
And have grown up rootless and without any sense of stability or security. It's heartbreaking.
Yes.
And I highly recommend it if you've never seen it.
Written by Naomi Foner, who is the mother of Jake and Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I did not know that.
Yes. I think she now goes by Naomi Foner Gyllenhaal.
Well, then.
Because with you.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, my kids are famous now? Okay. Gonna change my professional name.
Mm-hmm. My DVD pick this week is Drunktown's Finest, a film that premiered at Sundance a few years ago from Sydney Freeland, who I have since gotten to know. I think she's great. She also directed the Emmy-nominated web series Her Story. But it's a film that is set on a reservation, and pretty much all the characters are Native American, and she is Native American, and... yeah, so, you know, after Wind River, I kind of feel like this is the sort of movie I would like to see more of.
We have a letter.
All right.
Pause, please, while I pull it up.
Okay.
This is from Daniel. Hi, Dave and Alonzo. Interestingly, your Seamless Summer Super Splash podcast came out the week after a very interesting article about rape in Movies by April Wolf.
Yes, in LA Weekly.
If I hadn't read that, I probably wouldn't have known about Jodorowsky saying that he actually raped Mara Lorenzo in El Topo. I think knowing that will interfere with how I feel about the movie if I ever see it, rather how I cannot watch Last Tango in Paris after hearing about the treatment of Maria Schneider. Assuming that they really did these things in order to make the performances better and not because they are just sick perverts, if the actor you hire isn't up to the job, then get one who is. They seem not to be able to trust their actors to just do their jobs. It's usually aimed at women. Male actors are trusted to be able to do it without too much manipulation. The idea that you have to abuse and even rape an actress to get what you want is repulsive, and it seems like that era of filmmaking was pretty dangerous to actresses. Beyond just the horror of these actresses possibly actually being raped and filmed, I find that the behavior of these directors is just disgusting. There are some things I can't ignore once I've heard them. Thanks, Daniel. After getting this letter, I went and did some research. All stuff I didn't know.
Ew.
And it's not... It doesn't sound like good news at all.
There's a lot we don't know, but what we do know ain't great.
In El Topo, Mara Lorenzo is the actress. This character is raped by El Topo. And apparently, you know, the idea is that it liberates her.
This is per Jodorowsky.
And when I saw this film, I thought of it as a horror moment. You know, like the it's been a while since I've seen the movie. Rape is horrible, and that is a horrible situation. Then there's the quote from Jodorowsky. And it has been suggested by some that this quote might be not accurate because perhaps he was speaking in Spanish and it was translated weirdly or whatever. But the way he describes the scene as it was shot, that, you know, she consented to the scene and...
He
told her to attack him, and he was going to attack her back. I don't know what to make of that, you know. You know, she said, if in fact she consented to film the scene and the sex is unsimulated, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. But let's say that all of that is true. Let's say that his quote was weird and not translated properly. Let's say that she consented to the scene of actually having sex with him on camera, and it was,
agreed upon director and actress.
Agreed upon that this was a rape scene. As you read more of this Jodorowsky quote, what it says, it's an old quote, you know, maybe he's changed now that he's 88 years old.
It was almost 50 years ago.
What he understands about women and the act of rape and what it means and what the man's responsibility is very off-putting and wrong.
Yeah.
Really.
Neanderthal.
Really wrong. In a way that makes me understand Mad Men a whole lot more. Mm. Remember that scene where Joan's military husband rapes her on the floor?
Yes.
And he's just like, that's what I'm allowed to do. I'm your husband.
Yeah.
And she deals with it. She just goes off and lives with it.
Right. Because she, too, had probably been taught all of her life
that was okay.
That is what your husband is allowed to do.
So this certainly colors my understanding of this film and of this man as a director. I would like to hear from her. From Mara Lorenzo.
Yeah.
She's interviewed in a film, in a documentary that I have not seen.
Yes, Midnight
Movies.
But
I don't know if they talk about that
in the
documentary.
We'll have to track it down.
I'd like to hear from him now.
Mm.
His memory of that moment and what it meant to him, what he thinks about it now? Is this, you know, what happened? I feel very, very unpleasant about this film now. And I'm going to see what more I can figure out about it and what more I can learn about this situation.
Right.
I would, you know, your predisposition as with a filmmaker that you really like is to say, well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt that they're not monsters.
Right.
You know, because I just reviewed Endless Poetry.
I know.
And thought it was great. Before I learned about this.
Yeah.
And I'd seen El Topo and didn't read that scene as, that rape sure was good for her. You know what I mean? Like, right.
Which is how Yudorovsky talks about it. He talks about the stone phallus. Like, yeah. You know, water comes out because she hasn't.
He actually says that Mara Lorenzio had been raped in her actual life before, and so she knew what to bring to the scene, and that it was, and that she had a sexual dysfunction and the rape fixed her. Like, and I'm thinking, did you ask her that?
Yeah.
Did she say that to you? I just can't imagine that that's real.
Yeah.
That she really said that. Anyway, that's not good.
No.
So thanks for that letter. That's all the letters for this week.
You've given us something to think about.
You've given us something to investigate.
Research, yeah.
You've given us something to investigate further, because that's just...
Yeah.
That's not good.
No.
All right. Well, we're done.
We're done.
With this episode. Had to end that episode on a gross note.
So, if you want more of me, I am...
There's a whole lot more of you.
As we mentioned, I'm filling in on Pop Rocket for the next few months, so check that out. Also, I was fortunate enough to be a guest on the Comics Canon with Kurt and Kevin to talk about Carl Barks and the Uncle Scrooge McDuck comics, so download that one as well. I just found the new podcast that totally appeals to one of my... areas of interest, Christmas Past. They did about 13 episodes last year. They're all short, and they're all just about different sort of facets of Christmas history, like when did we start sending Christmas cards, and where did wrapping paper come from, and a three-part episode about the history of Santa Claus, which was fascinating.
Uh-huh.
So definitely check that one out if you are a cuckoo for Christmas like I am, or, you know, wait until November and listen to it then. That's fine, too. And of course, check out our friends on the internet. The B Movies podcast is no more, sadly.
That's true.
RIP B Movies podcast, but yeah. You can still hear Bibbs and Whitney every week on Cancel Too Soon. And if you join their Patreon and you join our Patreon, you can hear our LKTV Cancel Too Soon crossover episode. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife for more information about that. Check out The Schmoes Know and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, Film Spotting SVU, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Linoleum Cast. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Please leave us a positive review there. We have actually three new nice reviews forgot to send you, but I'll send them to you next week so we can read them out loud. But thank you for that, those of you who left them. And if you haven't, go leave us one. It helps us stand out in a crowded marketplace. You can also leave positive feedback in all the places where we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean and all the other ones. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. And thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go to bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA, for what he's up to. And we will catch y'all next time.
Goodbye.